Accession number 9168, rule number 4.
Mr. Amat, reel 4. Did you take part in any of the raiding parties?
Yes, several times. They never used to ask for volunteers. They used to say, you, and you, and you were in the party. And they usually went over in silence at night. And you didn't carry any equipment. You know, all you carried was a rifle and bayonet. That's a few details for that. The parties were arranged like this. Number one was the rifleman. He carried a rifle and bayonet and 50 rounds of ammunition and nothing else. The next man was a bomb thrower, a grenade thrower, and he only carried a haversack, plus, which was full of bilges and grenades. And the next man, he also was a bomb thrower, and he helped the first man replace his stock when he exhausted. And the last man was a rifle and bayonet man, and all he carried was a rifle and 50 rounds of ammunition and a bandolier slung over his shoulder, nothing else. And what the idea was to crawl through the German wire. Nearly always try and get underneath and jump into their front line trench, dispose of whoever was holding it, either by bayonet if possible without making any noise, or clubbing over the head with the butt. Then you drop into the trench once you establish yourself and wend your way round each bay. First of all, a rifleman would go leading, and then he'd stop at the next bay, which was normally a pot which was unoccupied, and the bomb thrower would then throw a grenade towards the next bay of their line, or where he thought it would be, judging from the distance of the other one. And when that exploded, just after it exploded, the man who was leading, the rifleman, he'd dash round into the trench where the bomb they had just gone off and dispose of any occupants that were left behind. And so he'd go on until we cleared the whole trench, you see, and other parties would be on the same thing, probably two or three, until we probably cleared about 100 yards of trench and brought back some prisoners. Anybody that actually had survived any grenade and was more or less stupefied, they'd take them prisoner, disarm them, take them prisoner, take them back, so that they could identify what regiment they were up against, opposite them.
What happened to the prisoners then?
Well, they were taken back and by various sentries and taken to, first of all, the unit's headquarters to be interviewed by one of the officers, and then after that taken right back to brigade and division headquarters to be questioned by interrogating officers so they could glean what information they could from who was holding the line in front of us.
Would your job always be the same in a raiding party, or might you have different jobs to do?
Oh no, you changed over. I mean, I was trained to throw grenades and in bayonet fighting and all that sort of thing. They never said. Usually, it was the biggest one of a party used to be chosen as the rifle and bayonet man in front, because he had the best chance of fighting a German, because they nearly all of the German soldiers I saw come in contact with were much bigger than us, and all the others, the smaller chaps, were the ones who used to throw the grenades. But they didn't seem to be very successful, because invariably, by the time we got halfway across no man's land and come up against the Jerry wire, the Germans had found out there was something going on, and they'd open up their machine guns and guns, on that area, so we'd have to scuttle back and get back into our own lines before we all got killed.
Did you ever actually get into the German trench?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I got in several German trenches, but the only ones I can remember, it was only one, I think, that was manned, and the others were... What had happened, you see, is in those days the Germans had nearly always held the high ground, and they were able to construct dugouts. Well, what used to happen was the Germans used to, after any strafing by our artillery, used to retire to these dugouts, and some of the trenches were left more or less vacant. They were all in the dugouts, you see. But some of them were occupied, and the Germans never... Then they'd always put their hands up and shouted "Kamerad" without any opposition at all once you got in the trench amongst them. Unless you were happened to go up against the Prussian guards, and of course they were like our own guards, you see, they were very elite fighting men, and they'd never give up. But I never come across them, fortunately. Nearly all Saxons who were very much... akin to us, or the Bavarians, but never the Prussians, not in my time anyway.
What did you feel when you met the Germans face to face?
Oh, I don't remember now. You see, at this time, we'd been through so much, even I, in my little time up there, that we come to become what they used to call fatalists. And what is to be, will be, sort of attitude. And that's what we all had, you see. So it was more or less you didn't feel any emotion at all, really. Only that you were glad you were holding the upper hand. That's all it amounted to.
Did you have any impression of them as soldiers?
Anyone?
Any impressions of them as soldiers?
Oh, yes, they were very good soldiers. And actually... all for all, we were lucky to win the war, I think, because although our chaps eventually made good soldiers, the Germans had been trained years before the war and were all good soldiers, whereas we had to fight and train at the same time, whereas they were, their old army was well trained in all that sort of thing, and they were much bigger and stronger men than us. When I see pictures in some of these war magazines that were out at that time, you could tell that we were nowhere near as big physically as what they were.
When they came on raiding parties over to the British trenches, did any of the Germans make it into the British frontline trenches?
Oh, yes. Several times. Not during 1916 when I first went out there, but later on when I went out again, they did. And the Germans used to adopt a tactic which we copied afterwards, and that was they pick out big, strong, physically fit young men, and they'd have nothing else but the uniform on and a club in their hand, a long-handled club, very much like a policeman's truncheon, only about twice as long, with a weighted end. And they'd crawl over with their faces blacked and get through our wire and drop into a trench. And without making any noise at all, they'd probably lift one of our sentries out bodily. Two of them, lift him out of the trench and drag him over to their lines without anybody noticing anything at all. Yeah, that's what we're all aware of. And eventually they strengthened the, instead of one sentry, they used to have two mostly put on bays at time when they got wise to that sort of thing. And you never heard anything at all when these people came over. We lost several of our men like that. We look around and say, oh, where's so-and-so? And he'd gone. They weren't doing anything about it.
And what did the Germans do to them?
Well, I don't know. I never happened to be one of those unlucky ones who was yanked out. But I found out afterwards that they were taken prisoner, and the same as I was eventually. But, of course, I would take prisoner in a different circumstance altogether.
Did you come into contact with the French forces?
Oh, yes,
you
yes.
There?
On that Leboeuf's action, after we'd gone over the top and the sergeant major had come along and told us to stop digging trenches, I was detailed with some more to get in touch with the French line. It was the left of the French line. We were on our right of the British line, you see. We had to go along 200 or 300 yards, of four or five of us, and eventually we found the French line and got in touch with them. And they were in all well deep dug trenches, and they didn't want us to go anywhere near them because we'd draw attention to their gunners that there was something happening because they could see us going along. And they more or less resented their appearance. Anyway, we got in touch with them, and that was all we needed to do. So we went back and reported, and just as we turned out of their trench and went to go back, the Germans spotted us and fired at us with their whiz-bangs. And one came along, and I never heard it. And next minute, I was up to my shoulders and my neck in loose earth. The shell had burst and thrown all the earth all over me. And I was laying out there with my arms, a rifle out of my hand, and buried up to my neck. Anyway, with the help of my pals, I scrambled out. But it was very shocking, really. It shook me terribly. And we eventually rejoined our unit. And and we went back, as I said before, to the lines. That's the only time I came in contact with the French in action.
What did you think of them?
All over fine big men, and nearly all of them had beards, and they all had those blue, darkish blue uniforms on. And I remember one thing about them is when it was muddy, nearly always muddy out there, our overcoats used to come down about halfway below our knees, between our knees and our ankles, about halfway. And when it was muddy, when we just get in these shallows and mud and water and all that, the bottom part of our overcoat was absolutely soggy and full of mud, and it used to delay our progress and drag us down. But the French, they made their uniform so that the front part of the overcoat used to fold back and button up at the rear, so that almost from the waist down, or a little bit below the waist down, was all free, and that just their trousers and their boots, and it didn't lag them down. That's one thing I noticed about the French uniform.
When you were in the trenches and you weren't on sentry duty, what did you do?
Well, if it was daylight, you were put on cleaning up trenches, of all things. That's one thing about the British Army. They never allowed you any time to yourself if they could find a job for you to do to occupy your time. And we used to have to go along the trench and pick up cigarette ends, matchsticks, or packets, cigarette packets, or anything like that had been laying about, and get it all nicely tidied up so that when the officer came round, they used to come round if it was fairly quiet, somewhere about 8:30, 9 o'clock in the morning, and had a look round, and they made sure that everything was all ship-shape before they came round. I don't know why it wasn't really necessary, but I suppose it kept our mind off the terrible times we were having.
How much rest did you get?
Well, it's all according, as I said before, it's all according to how many men you had in any particular area. Some areas I was in, you only had 1 hour. You had 1 hour on the fire step and 1 hour off, so that you was more or less That was the whole time. So you more or less didn't get any rest at all. But these tours of duty we did up in the trenches used to last up to about a week. And in some of the quieter areas, like Levante where I was, near Labassi, you'd be up there perhaps 2 or 3 weeks, alternating between the front line and the reserve line. But in the other areas where it used to be stirred up every few days, it wouldn't be like that at all. It'd only be, perhaps you might do 2 hours on and 2 hours off sentry duty, but never anything like in the quieter areas at all.
Did you have dugouts where you could shelter? And
No dugouts at all. The only dugouts we had was the ones we took from the Germans. The British idea in those days, and the Allies, the French and Belgians and all those, was they were supposed to be attacking all the time, whereas the Germans, on the other hand, were defending. So that was the idea of the whole thing, you see. We never made dugouts because we didn't want to stop in that area at all. We wanted to go forward and win the war, whereas the Germans were better versed in those things. They dug the dugouts, and some of the dugouts I saw when we went over there and took these lines was very elaborate. They had electric lights, electric cables running along from the rear areas, and electric lights inside the dugouts, and wooden double-tier beds and all that sort of luxury that we'd never ever experienced at all.
Could you describe the British frontline trenches?
Very muddy, normally, and it's all according to what area you was in. As I say, at Labassi, it was all breastworks, and in the other areas when you could dig, like on the Somme and round Arras, the trench was about 6 foot or so deep, and there was a fire step about a foot above the level of the trench, and each trench was formation was there was a bay and sort of zigzag kind of trench, so that you couldn't be enfiladed from either flank. You just simply dug down to the earth, threw the earth up to the right and left, and built up your parapet with the aid of sandbags and any odd bits of material you could find around. In a village area, you build it up with bricks and mortar and all sorts of things that you could lay your hands on. Anything to be out of the fire of machine guns and rifles. Although, up to a point, it was a protection from shell fire as well.
Were you cold?
Oh, yes, very cold. In the winter, we had our normal clothes. We had thick woolen underwear and woolen shirts. Well, not woolen, but similar material. And then we had a cardigan or a pullover, and then our uniform, and on top of that we had our overcoat. And during the winter of 1917, we had sheepskin coats issued for the troops who were manning the front line only, and that was over the top of your overcoat, and that was a leather, sheepskin leather coat with the fleece still on it, and you put it on so that the fleece was outward.
Did these clothes...
And you had gauntlets, large gloves, if you're up the front line only, otherwise you had woolen gloves issued to you, and you had a woolen scarf which acted as a cover for your head after you'd taken your steel helmet off. You weren't allowed to go about unless you had a steel helmet on and your respirator fixed around your chest. These respirators came in 1916 with the advent of the Lewis gun. And you had to wear them all the time, these respirators.
How effective were they?
Oh, they were very effective. Although, before then, when I first went out to France, our anti-gas respirators consisted of a hood made of flannelette in which was inserted an eyepiece with a sort of perspect window from which you could look out, and there was a tube fixed to one part of the flannelette that you put into your mouth, and the other and another part of the line of the flannelette contained a clip very much like a clothespin. And when you donned this respirator, you threw it over your head and then made this clip over your nostrils so that you could only breathe through your mouth. And you had this rubber type thing you put in your mouth, and you breathe the air through your mouth, through the fabric of the flannelette, which was impregnated with some chemical, which was killed the gas that was in the air. Then as you breathed out through the tube into the open air. And this was so constructed that you could breathe out, but you couldn't breathe in through it. That was the first respirators we had. Then after that, you got the box respirator, which was with a canister of charcoal on all that, where you breathe through. And that was much more effective. But the point about the gas was, after 1915 and early 1916, instead of using clouds of gas issued from cylinders, they'd fill shells with gas. And these would be fired. You could always tell, nearly always tell, it was a gas shell, because there was no explosion. You'd hear the shell coming over and a plonk on the mud or the ground or wherever it was, and then that used to release the gas in there. This gas used to come out, but it was colourless. I mean, you couldn't see it at all, not visually, although you could, if you inhaled it, you knew that it was gas, all right. They used to use a lot of what was called mustard gas in those days, which affected your lungs and sort of burnt you up, you see. So any time these shells came over and the alarm went, you had to don one of these respirators, you see, to stop you from getting gas. But nearly always, unless we thought the shell would land very close, we never used to worry about putting a respirator on, because it was such an encumbrance to us.
Were you not worried about being gassed?
Well, as I say, in those days, after I'd been out there some months in France and seen all and been through what I'd been through, you became a fatalist, and you never worried about from day to day. As long as you got something to eat and somewhere to sleep, that's all you worried about. You simply had to go on from day to day, and more or less hour to hour in some areas.
Did you see any of your comrades suffering from gas attacks?
Oh, yes, yes. Yes, terrible, really, because you could see they were suffering. They was gasping, and like anybody suffering with asthma, they have an attack. Terrible to watch them. And invariably, these people had to go through a long period of medical to get them back in normal, and a lot of them never sort of recovered at all. They all suffered with it for the rest of their life, especially the mustard gas, which affected your lungs.
What could you do for them at the time?
Nothing really. The only thing is sort of try and cheer them up if you could, but there's no material available which would ease their suffering at all, not as I know of anyway. We used to help them back and get them to the nearest medical centre so they can be treated.
Did you have medical orderlies come to the front lines?
Oh, yes. Each unit, well, each platoon had a stretcher bearer or a chap detailed as a medical orderly, as you call them. And I'd been through a course like that myself. And I knew all the drill about how to bandage people and how to stop blood flowing and all those things. Yes, they were pretty good at that, but because the trouble is, in some of the actions, they were some of the people who suffered. They got killed and all, or got wounded, and you have to sort of rely on, well, you couldn't rely on anybody, you just happened to be lucky, that's all it amounted to.
How far away were the hospitals?
Oh, the main hospitals are all at the base, Le Havre, Etaps, Calais, Boulogne, and Rouen, but there was they were the base hospital, but then they were just what they call casualty clearing stations, CCS, and they were halfway between the base and the front line, and they took all the casualties that come from the front line through their camps, nearly always camps, tented camps mostly, and they were about, well, perhaps might be 50 or 60 miles behind the lines, and all the casualties, either sick, wounded or what have you, used to go through their hands, you see.